Welcome to Off Script with Dan Dwyer on Robinhood Radio, featuring in-depth interviews with guests from the world of theater and allied arts. Underwriting support from Johnny Cake Books in Salisbury, Connecticut, whose collection of rare collectible and out-of-print books is housed in a 19th century cottage in one of the most old-fashioned small towns in New England. And now, here's the host of Off Script, Dan Dwyer.
Well, thanks, Marshall, and welcome to Off Script. Today, we're going to go off script and about theater and talk instead about movies, specifically one of the great American movie classics from the 1950s, Giant. My guest today is Don Graham. By position and title, the Frank Dobie Regent Professor of English at the University of Texas at Austin, but in effect, the premier authority on Texas literature, film, and pop culture. Author of 6 books on Texas history and pop culture. His latest, just published by St. Martin's Press, is Giant, Elizabeth Taylor, Rock Hudson, James Dean, Edna Ferber, and the Making of a Legendary American Film. Welcome to Off Script, Don.
Hi, glad to be here.
Well, thanks for joining us. Before we start, I want to ask you to join me in a little puzzle for our listeners, because we mostly talk about theater, and now we're talking about movies today. I have a theater quiz that relates to your book, and for those who are really into theater, it's not a particularly hard question. It's sort of on the level of a New York Times Monday crossword puzzle. But the question is, how does Edna Ferber, who's the author of Giant, and the subject of your book, how does Edna Ferber figure into the history of the American stage? And if you just humor me a little bit, we'll spring the answer to that little quiz question at the end of the show, okay?
Okay, that's fine.
Okay, good. So the book, Giant, about the making of this American classic right down there in Texas, how did this book come about?
Well, I've long time been interested in the movie. I saw it when I was 16 years old in Dallas, and I never forgot it. And so over the years, after I became a professor, I kept writing little bits and pieces about Giant in one book or another. And in 1986, my wife and I spent 3 days on the actual ranch where Giant was filmed out in Marfa. I was on my way to California to write together information about a book on Audie Murphy, the war hero. So I could have written the book back then. And then in 1996, I was in a documentary film called Return to Giant, which was a lot of fun to do. I was a talking head on that. And still, I hadn't written. And then finally, around 2010 or so, I decided it was time to write it. And I was coming up on the 60th anniversary, so that was kind of the connection point in my mind.
Well, good for you, and congratulations on the book. I liked a lot of things about it. One of the things that's, first of all, it's economically written. For those who read it, and there's a splendid bibliography and annotations in the back, but for reading, it's 260 pages, so it's a nice, comfortable read. It's impeccably researched. For those of us with a book or background, your dive into archival material to get contemporary quotations from the figures in the books is really extraordinary. And it also has a page-turning quality. I really wanted to see how all these personalities that found themselves in Marfa, Texas, making this movie, were going to relate to each other. But before we get into the details of all of that, for those of us who have been under a rock or are not of a certain age, as you were when you saw the movie Giant, can you briefly outline for us what the plot dimensions are, the basic story of Giant?
Yes, I can. The movie begins actually in Virginia when a Texas rancher from a very large ranch goes to Virginia. It's Maryland in the film. And he goes there to buy a horse, a stud horse. And while there, he meets the daughter of the horse's owner. And it turns out that he falls in love with her and she falls in love with him. The daughter, of course, is played by Elizabeth Taylor. But before they fall in love, they have a big argument about Texas, because she stays up all night reading about Texas. And she comes down and she says, basically, you know, we actually stole Texas from Mexico, didn't we? So he gets furious at her about that. And there's this little debate about Texas history. and the size of his ranch and so on. And then we cut away from the Virginia scene, and we see them arriving in this barren desert country of far west Texas. The train drops them off, and there's Elizabeth Taylor confronted with an automobile trip of 50 miles to their ranch house. So it's this well-bred, educated, upper-class woman from Virginia winds up in Texas married to this handsome cowboy who also turns out a rancher. He turns out to be very unsympathetic to the Mexican workers on his ranch, and a clash is set up between them because she's very nice to them and does a lot of good things for these people that work there. And he throughout is kind of cold and patriarchal and so on. And they go on to live together and have a happy marriage, but it's not without its problems along the way. And that's one of the things a lot of people don't remember about the film, is how great a family story it is. But the main antagonist in the film is a ranch hand, kind of a redneck type, played by James Dean, and his name is Jett Rink. And Jett Rink is left a parcel of land by Rock Hudson's sister, Big Benedict's sister, and it makes Benedict very angry because he doesn't want his ranch broken up. But his sister, like Jett Rink, she dies and leaves him that parcel of land. And so Jett Rink strikes oil on it, and suddenly he becomes the richest oil man in all of Texas. And the clash goes on for the rest of the film between Jett Rink, and Jett Rink, by the way, whom modern viewers today really, really like. I do too. And they think it's sort of, that he's the star of the movie. He's not the star of the movie. He's the third lead. But he's so powerful an actor that it seems like at times he is the star. But he's a real racist all the way through. And so the film sort of tracks family life. One of the funniest things in the film, or most interesting in a way, is that the children of Vic and Leslie Benedict never do anything that their parents want. The young boy who is supposed to be the heir to managing the ranch and take it over, he can't even ride a pony. He's not any good at ranch life, and he wants to be a doctor, and that's what he does. So he marries a Mexican American woman who's a nurse, and that really is something his father can't accept. He can't accept the idea of having a blood relation who is from Mexican heritage. All of this is resolved in the famous diner scene at the end when, first there's the scenes at the hotel. Jett Rink, based on Glenn McCarthy, a real Texas oil man, and Jett Rink turns away Juana, the Mexican wife of young Benedict, from his new hotel that he's opening, in which he's celebrating and so on. The film, Jett Rink's part ends with him drunk at a banquet hall in the hotel, he's out of the picture at that point. Right. So anyway, in the diner scene, Rock Hudson confronts a racist owner of a cafe who won't serve a Mexican family, and Rock Hudson fights him. It's a long fight played to the soundtrack of The Yellow Rose of Texas, very powerful scene. And Rock Hudson, to the astonishment of everybody in the 1950s, loses the fight because he's portrayed as the heroic figure. But the point is, there's an arc of sort of redemption on the part of Rock, because he comes to recognize and publicly accepts the idea that that cute little Mexican boy, half Mexican, half white, is his grandson.
He's also on as the story points out, and you do in your book, he's also on the losing end of history in Texas, because he loses, or his fortune in cattle fades as the racist James Dean, Jett Rink, makes his fortune in oil. And that's a big part of the story.
And one of the things that I think is worth pointing out is that there's no better subsidy for the ranching industry than oil.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Because he immediately builds a swimming pool once he starts getting royalties his relationship with James Dean.
In case you're just joining us and wondering about all this Texas talk, we're talking about Giant, the name of a book by Don Graham, the Texas authority on Texas literature and culture. And it's his book about the making of that classic American 1956 film. The book is way beyond, and I don't mean this comparison in any derogatory way. It is so way beyond the making of genre because it's got such hefty archival research behind it. But one of the behind-the-scenes things that people, I think, would be fascinated by about the book, particularly given what icons Elizabeth Taylor and Rock Hudson and James Dean have become, is who was considered for these roles originally? Whom did the studio originally consider to play the Elizabeth Taylor part?
Audrey Hepburn. That was the one.
Which I found amazing. Amazing.
I agree. She's totally, it seems to be totally a different kind of actor. And she was in actually one Western later on, and she broke her back falling off a horse. the next choice was Grace Kelly. Grace Kelly really wanted to do it, and I think she could have done it.
What about the role that Rock Hudson took?
Rock Hudson beat out every Hollywood star from Clark Gable to William Holden.
Okay. And what about the role that James Dean became famous for among the other two that he did?
Right. Stevens offered that part to Alan Ladd. And Alan Ladd, of course, had starred in Shane in 1953, another great Stevens film. And Alan Ladd foolishly turned it down because he said, I'm a star and I can't take a secondary role. And later, Alan Ladd said that was the biggest mistake of his life.
The other little irony that I picked up in the book was that at one point, Richard Burton, whom we all know figured isn't Elizabeth Taylor, was once considered for the role that James Dean took.
That's right. And history could have been changed if he had done it. The reason he didn't, he took himself out of the running because he said he just couldn't wrap his tongue around that Texas accent.
Uh-huh.
But if he had taken the role, he and Elizabeth Taylor could have perhaps married earlier.
They could have saved a lot of time, maybe. Right. Anyway, we think because Elizabeth Taylor and Rock Hudson became such mega movie stars that they were always movie stars. But explain to us how much of a breakthrough roles each of these parts was for them in this particular point in their careers.
Well, Elizabeth Taylor was kind of stuck. She had made one really wonderful movie, and it was a George Stevens movie, A Place in the Sun, 1951. But after that, she was just getting role after role after role at MGM that were minor, and she just felt like she was wasting her talent, she wasn't growing, etc. So she basically just thrust herself into contention for the role in Giant, and it certainly led to her a big improvement in her image as an actress and so on. So people could take her seriously because they just regarded her as a pretty face, which she was.
Right.
But she had a lot of very, she was a very strong actor. And the next, she was nominated for four films in a row and then finally won an Academy Award for Butterfield 8.
Which she hated.
Well, yeah, she used an unprintable word to describe it. And Rock Hudson had worked his way up from absolutely nothing. He didn't know anything about anything when he wound up getting a contract through his agent, Henry Wilson. He got a contract with Universal. So he appeared in all kinds of movies, minor parts and so on, and was learning his craft and so on. And in 1954, the year before they started making Giant, he was in Magnificent Obsession, which was a Douglas Sirk weepy or melodrama, so on. And it found an audience, a niche audience with women, and he would make a lot more films with that director, Douglas Sirk. But Giant was something different. Giant, everybody in Hollywood was shocked at this basic minor figure who was not a star. They were shocked at him getting that role. Mm-hmm. And he knew it was the best role of his life. He said at one point later in his life that he saw the movie 40 times. So I think he liked it.
One of the most satisfying aspects of your book is that you describe, as you have just done, how these personalities found themselves at different points in their career and what was at stake, and also the kinds of idiosyncrasies that they brought to the set. When we get to Marfa and they started the shooting, and before that in Hollywood, where they did the interiors, there's a very interesting dynamic that I'd like you to talk about. Liz adored Rock. Rock adored Liz. Liz ended up adoring James Dean. He liked her, but Rock and James Dean really disliked each other. Can you talk about this very, very odd triumvirate of relationship?
Right. Elizabeth Taylor was the medium between the two. And she was, as you pointed out, became very close friends. She didn't know James Dean before this. They became very close friends. She and Rock Hudson became lifelong friends. And it must be remembered and admired that she went public when Rock Hudson's AIDS was announced in 1985. She stood by him all the way, and that was a brave thing for her to do. But back in Marfa, she and Rock would spend their nights drinking together. And James Dean was very jealous. He wanted in on everything. And he competed with Rock all the way through, trying to steal Elizabeth Taylor's affections. And not that this was sexual, but just this deep bond, this deep friendship. And there's some indication, you can't prove it, that Rock Hudson tried to hit on James Dean early on. They were in the same house with an older actor named Chill Wills. And there's some conversations that were had by Wills and that are on the record that indicate some kind of verbal fight between the two of them. At any rate, James Dean moved out of that house after a week and lived in the Pisano Hotel, where most of the people, most of the actors and cast were staying. But James Dean professionally, during the making of the film, when they were on camera, James Dean irritated Elizabeth Taylor just as much as he did Rock Hudson, because of his method acting, his verbal tics, his mumblings, his physical movements. He was always trying to steal every scene. And Rock Hudson had been trained, you know, to speak in a kind of formal way, or you could see that Rock Hudson was always acting, and James Dean was doing something else, it felt like.
Right. Your book is remarkably detailed in its history of the sexual orientation of both Dean and Hudson. You make it plain that, you know, Rock was obviously an active homosexual, even though he had a contrived marriage that occurred during the filming of this. But your research on James Dean is particularly compelling. Do you think he was what you would call, millennials would call, fluid in his sexuality? Some people would regard him as an equal opportunity employer. He clearly had a lot of sex with men. He was also an opportunist with women. Do you think it's fair to say that James Dean could be described as a sexual grifter?
Pretty much.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. Yeah. Well, comment, if you would, as you were a scholar on this, why it is the irony that this great movie stars like Elizabeth Taylor and Rock Hudson, but nowadays, if you talk about the movie and if you look at the visual presentation of it and if it's graphics and all that, people think of James Dean as the star when he's really the bad guy in the story.
That's right. Yeah, he is. He's actually, I think a lot of people are sympathetic to him in the first part of the film because he's an outsider. He's treated badly by Bick as well. And he's got this kind of core resentment and so on. But he also obviously is racist from the very first scene or second scene that he's in the film. I lost the thread of your question.
Well, that's all right, because I've got another question, because we should get off the movie stars and get to the real guts of this. Let's talk a little bit about the relationship between George Stevens and Edna Ferber. You make it really compelling in your book about how George Stevens was really perfect to direct this movie because he believed in the old-fashioned basic fundamentals of liberal democracy, as Edna Ferber did. She was a real progressive in the themes she tackled in her books. But at some point, they really diverged about how some of these personalities were going to play out within the parameters of a movie melodrama. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I can. I'm not sure I talk about it exactly this way, but your question is a good one. It seems to me that the difference between them, they were both very interested in Texas as a kind of representative American place, okay, maybe because of all its material wealth during that period. And Texas was a very famous state, but Ferber basically hated Texas, and George Stevens didn't. George Stevens hated the racism, and so did Ferber. But Ferber, in her novel, wouldn't allow her main character, the Rock Hudson character, to have any moral growth at all. He's the same at the end as he was at the beginning. And in fact, the diner scene where he undergoes his conversion to accepting his Mexican-American grandson, that diner scene in the novel, he's not in it. He's not in the scene. And the Benedict women are made to leave the restaurant because they have that little boy with them, and they don't get to stay there and have lunch or whatever, and there's no fight. It's all, in a way, the novel's kind of depressing because it says, well, in about 100 years, maybe Texas will change.
And even though the movie in the 1950s was tackling big themes, the way to get those across to an audience wasn't by doing it black or doing it in a depressing way, I don't think.
I agree with you.
Yeah. Let me just put this question on the table. Given how Trump has created such an anti-immigration fervor in the country right now, do you think this is an occasion for people to go back and watch Giant?
Yeah, I think it is. And I actually provide this occasion in my class that I teach at the University of Texas because I teach a course called Life and Literature of the Southwest. And I use Giant in there. And so these are all millennials. And many of them, God bless them, have never heard of Rock Hudson. They've never heard of Giant, Edna Ferber, et cetera. So I have them see the film, and I actually have them write about it. And they come away being really impressed with the way race is handled in a progressive way in the film. And they also come away with something we haven't mentioned, and that's the feminism exhibited by the Elizabeth Taylor character. There's this great scene in the film where she tries to enter a conversation that the male figures, her husband and the other ranchers and lawyers and one judge, they're all having a political discussion while the women are off in the corner knitting. And she comes over to join them. And there's a public, you know, in front of everybody, a confrontation between her and her husband about this. Uh-huh. And finally, Rock is so exasperated, he says, "Leslie, you're tired." He wants her to go to the classic put down. He wants her to go to bed, and she fumes out and goes to bed. Then when he comes up, they make up, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. But one final quick question, if I could.
Yeah,
are you
sure
bemused by Marfa now becoming sort of an artsy-fartsy art destination?
You got it right. That's artsy's it. Yeah, we love to go out to Marfa, but it's if you go out there, you're all the people there, all the tourists there, the hipsters from somewhere,
sure,
or Europe.
Yeah. Anyway, Don Graham, thank you very much for being here. And we got to spring on our audience now the answer to the question, how does Edna Ferber figure into the history of the American stage?
Do you want me to answer?
Yeah, go ahead.
Showboat.
Showboat, of course. The landmark American musical that set the stage for what the American musical became as how we now know it, right?
Absolutely.
Don, thank you very much. This has been swell. Don Graham's talking to us from Texas today. His book, Giant, Elizabeth Taylor, Rock Hudson, James Dean, Edna Ferber, and the Making of a Legendary American Film. Thank you, Don. Congratulations on a book, a great read, and a great interview.
Thanks a bunch. I enjoyed it.
And thank you, too, to Charlie Spicer, editor, and John Carley, Publicity Associate Director at St. Martin's Press, for making this interview happen. And thanks, which we don't often give, to Jill Goodman and Marshall Miles for everything they do for Robin Hood Radio in this community. And thank you all for listening. I, again, is Dan Dwyer, and the host. The program's been Off Script, underwritten by Johnny Cake Books in Salisbury, Connecticut. Until the next time you listen in, be well.
underwriting support for Off Script with Dan Dwyer from John and Cake Books in Salisbury, Connecticut, whose collection of rare, collectible, and out-of-print books is housed in a 19th-century cottage in one of the most old-fashioned small towns in New England. Off Script with Dan Dwyer is also available via podcast on our on-demand page, robinhoodradio.com. Click on On Demand, and then click on Off Script with Dan Dwyer.